And turn with me to 1 Corinthians chapter 1. 1 Corinthians chapter 1 this morning. Give you a chance to get there. As you're turning there, if you've been here, whenever we've had new members join our church, you know that it's our practice to have those new members share their salvation testimonies before the congregation, before we would officially welcome them into membership. That's a great joy, a privilege that we have. And I just want to ask you, how would it strike you if on one of those occasions where somebody has come up here to share their salvation testimony, if the person came up and they said this, they said, "Hello, my name is Jim, and for the last 20 years, I've been a professor of world religions at the University of Alberta." He's got tons of letters behind his name, and he says, "I actually got into that career path and into that field when I was just a young man right out of high school. I realized that I really wanted to search out and find the right religion for myself. And so I've devoted myself to that over the last 20 years of study. I have now come, after basically looking at any and every religion, any and every viewpoint, any and every philosophy, now after 20 years, I have come to the logical conclusion that Christianity just makes the most sense. I find, after all this study, I've searched them all out, this is the one. And I've decided that the God of the Bible is the only true God, and now I want to follow His teachings on the journey of life." You've just heard that testimony. Question: is Jim saved? Is he a follower of Jesus Christ? You probably say, "Well, obviously, I think I'm going to need a little bit more information." But you probably have question marks in your mind, and you may or may not know why, but you probably, like, there's something that I just don't know if it seems quite right. And maybe I could kind of put words to that. I suspect that your concern would be this: many people miss heaven by 18 inches, as it's often said, the distance from your head to your heart. And you are wondering, as Jim shares his testimony, if he's ever experienced the saving power of the gospel. In 1 Corinthians chapter 1, the Apostle Paul is concerned that we have a tendency to preach the cross or the gospel in such a way that empties it of its power. Isn't that a horrifying thought, that you or I could share the gospel or the message of the cross with someone in such a way that it's void of its power? How might we do that? Well, we share the gospel, Paul says in verse 17, with words of eloquent wisdom. That's Paul's concern. He says, God didn't make me an apostle so I could share the gospel in that fashion. In other words, what we do often is we address the gospel to people's heads instead of to their hearts, as if our highest aim is to win the minds of men. We present the gospel to people's heads as if the message of the cross were some sort of a philosophy to be assessed in the mind and embraced through logic. But it's not, is it? It's a message to be received in the heart by faith. And by God's wise design, the message of the cross is not actually intended to persuade man's mind, but instead to pierce his heart. As I think our text will make abundantly clear, the cross of Christ and human wisdom and logic are mutually exclusive. They do not go together. They are total opposites. So what does that mean practically for us as we would share the message of the cross? Well, it means that you and I must share the foolish message of the cross. We're not trying to share some wise message of the cross to people and make it palatable and tasteful to them in the way that they, "I see it. That makes so much sense. You've persuaded me to be a Christian." Your job is simply to herald the message of the King to the hearts of men and let it do its powerful work. It's your job to declare, to inform. And yes, all of that's going to go through the mind. But to declare and to inform people about the cross and its implications, and then to summon them to repentance and faith. And then to trust actually the power of the cross itself to convict, not the power of your eloquent wisdom. Look at 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 18 to 25. Actually, we'll pick up in verse 17. Paul writes, "For Christ did not send me to baptize, but to preach the gospel. And not with words of eloquent wisdom, lest the cross of Christ be emptied of its power. Verse 18, for the word of the cross is folly to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it's the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the discernment of the discerning I will thwart. Where is the one who is wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world did not know God through wisdom, it pleased God through the folly of what we preach to save those who believe. For Jews demand signs and Greeks seek wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and folly to Gentiles. But to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ the power of God and the wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. We're going to focus on the cross here together this morning, highlighting a few of its wonders. And first, I just draw your attention to the fact that the message of the cross impacts in two ways. Look at verse 18 again with me, if you would. For the word of the cross is folly to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it's the power of God. When the word of the cross is preached, when the gospel is preached, in some ways we could maybe compare it to a snowplow that's pointed. And as that plow moves forward, it's sending some snow this way, it's sending some snow that way. And as the gospel advances, as it goes forward, some people end up going this way, some people end up going that way. The gospel sends people in different directions. Obviously, we would say on the one side people reject it, on the other side they embrace it. But the gospel is having this effect. What effect is it having exactly? Well, some people assess it as foolish. Verse 18 begins, for the word of the cross is folly to those who are perishing. And to be a little bit more technical there, it's to those who are in the process of perishing. It's kind of this present tense idea. This is what's happening to these people. They're going towards destruction. And when a certain group of people hears the message of the cross, they make a mental assessment about it. So they do something in their mind. It's going to flow from a very hard heart, but something's going to happen in their mind. They're going to make a mental evaluation. And they're going to say, that's folly. That is madness. That's crazy. That's stupid. That's nonsense. That's impossible. That does not satisfy my mind. And in fact, I could poke holes through this message of the cross here, there, and everywhere with no problem at all. This message of the cross fails to answer my intellectual questions. As I mentioned, obviously that mental assessment comes from a hard heart, doesn't it? But those who are in the process of perishing assess the message of the cross as foolish. And in verse 19, these people are actually contrasted with a different group of people. Contrasted with us. With us who are being saved, or with us who are in the process of being saved. Now, as you read the first half of verse 18, what do you expect in the second? If it's going to be a true contrast, what would you expect the second half to say? You'd expect to read, for the word of the cross is folly to those who are perishing. They make a mental assessment that it is folly. But to us who are being saved, we'd expect to read that we would also make a mental assessment that it's wisdom. But that's not what God puts there, is it? He will get to that later in the passage. But in verse 18, he says something else. Some people assess the cross as foolish, but other people experience it as power. They experience the saving power of the gospel. The message of the cross is preached to them, and they have, and then they continue to have throughout their life the experience of divine power. Paul wrote elsewhere in Romans chapter 1, verse 16, he says, listen, I am not ashamed of the gospel. For it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first, and also to the Greek. For those of us who could say that we are being saved, we've been saved by grace through faith, and now we're in this process of God making us more like His Son, one day to be glorified and look like Jesus Christ. For those of us who are in that position, the message of the cross did not appeal to our minds. Do you know what it did? It struck us in our hearts. For those of us who are being saved, for those of you who that is you, isn't that your testimony? That this message somehow, at some point in time, maybe even over a bit of a process, it struck you straight to your heart. In Jeremiah 23, verse 29, we read this, "Is not my word like fire, declares the Lord, and like a hammer that breaks the rock in pieces?" That's God's word. And particularly the word of the cross. The word of the cross is like a hammer that breaks in pieces the stony hearts of men. Every teaching of the cross, every implication of the cross is like a hammer strike, a blow after blow after blow, straight to the stony heart of men and women and children. Through the powerful message of the cross, God shatters hearts of stone and He makes them new. God said to His people in Ezekiel 36, verse 26, He said to them, "I will give you a new heart. A new heart and a new spirit I will put within you, and I will remove the heart of stone from your flesh and give you a heart of flesh. I'm going to take a heart that is rock hard and I'm going to make it soft like flesh. I'm going to give you a new heart." When the message of the cross is preached, some people assess it as foolish and other people experience it as power. I have a compound bow that I really enjoy shooting, and I've always loved, like, I enjoy just shooting it, but one of the things I really enjoy is when you hear the arrow hit the target, just thump. It's such a cool sound. I don't know, maybe you can't appreciate it, but I just really like that sound. Thump, thump, thump. Particularly the further back you step 40 yards back, 50 yards, 60 yards, and you sort of watch your arrow maybe even loft a little bit and then drop back into the target, and then you hear like the delay, thump, thump. I love that. When God is calling a person to salvation, the facts of the cross and the implications of the cross become as sharp arrows sinking into his heart one after another. Thump, thump, thump. Again and again. All of these truths hitting him straight into his heart. And the cross says to people, it says, "You are a sinner." Thump. "You are guilty." Thump. "Condemned." Thump. "You cannot save yourself." Thump. And man, sitting there hearing this message, and every one of those is a blow straight to his heart. The cross doesn't ask you to evaluate it. It tells you, you are guilty. You are a sinner. And blow after blow after blow, the tenets of the cross are like arrows sinking into a target, crushing the pride of a man. And these arrows were fashioned first and foremost by God for the heart of man, not his intellect. God does not ask man to sit in judgment on his work and make a decision. He says, "Here's the truth." The message of the cross impacts two ways. The head of man will always find this message foolish, but it's the power of God to those who are believing. And when you share the message of the cross, knowing something like that, I think instead of presenting it as some kind of philosophy, "Don't you see this? Don't you see how it's so great? Don't you see how it's so wise? Don't you see how it makes so much sense? Look at it, evaluate, choose it." What do we do? What should we do? Well, we preach the cross. We keep bringing people back to the cross, and the cross goes straight to people's hearts. We present this foolish message unashamedly. We're not trying to give it a boost. We're not trying to make it seem wise. It's not. It's folly. A second wonder of the cross is that the message of the cross destroys man's wisdom. Remember that the message of the cross, we'll look at in the remainder of this text, it is folly to man. Absolute, total folly. The message of the cross and human wisdom are mutually exclusive. They are opposites. They do not mix. The message of the cross is folly to the wisdom of the human mind. Verses 19 to 24 actually provide for us an explanation for the two different outcomes that we see in verse 18. You have these two different outcomes. How do you explain that? What is God doing through the preaching of the cross? What God is doing is totally shattering and destroying the wisdom of man, which God promised to do. God promised to destroy man's wisdom, and that's exactly what he's done through the cross. Look at verse 19. Paul begins to offer an explanation for these responses. He says, "For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the discernment of the discerning I will thwart." That's a quotation from Isaiah 29, verse 14. You may have that reference at the bottom of your page somewhere. It's an Old Testament prophecy, given hundreds of years before Paul wrote 1 Corinthians, in which God promised to unravel and bring to nothing the wisdom of man. And he promised to thwart the intelligence of man. And right here in this verse, we don't exactly know what he's talking about just yet. But our passage makes clear that God fulfilled and is fulfilling that prophecy in Isaiah 29:14 through the message of the cross. It's the cross that unravels and destroys and makes foolish the wisdom of man. One writer said it this way: God's actions make the worldly wise look like blundering fools. So you have a prophecy way back in the book of Isaiah where God says, I'm going to destroy, I'm going to unravel the wisdom of man. I'm going to make the wisdom of man into total folly. He promised to destroy man's wisdom, and do you know what? God has done that very thing. God has destroyed man's wisdom. Look at verse 20. After bringing this prophecy before our eyes, he says, where is the one who is wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? All three of those people at the beginning of the verse would have been to the people of their time. They would have been the intellectuals. They would have been the philosophers. They would have been perceived as professional experts. They're the thinkers, teachers, and philosophers of their time. And God asks, where are these people? Is God saying that you don't see those people in the church? He's saying, take a look around. Where are those people? Where are they among the redeemed of God? Is he saying that because they're not the ones that tend to get saved? Or is he saying that those people, these philosophers and teachers, should stand up and provide an answer to what he's done in the cross? I actually really don't know. I think there's a few different options there. But what God is driving at becomes very clear in the next verse. His point, or at the end of the verse, rather. It comes at the end, and he says this at the end of verse 20. Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? And the implied answer is yes, he has. What God promised to do in verse 19, he says in verse 20, I've done it. What I promised back in Isaiah to destroy the wisdom of man, I have done that very thing. And the verses that follow explain just exactly how God has destroyed and brought to nothing the wisdom of man. He's done it through the means and plan of salvation, the very foolish message of the cross and of a crucified Messiah. God has destroyed man's wisdom. How so? By choosing to save people by faith. Verse 21, I want you to skip down to the second half of that verse initially here. Verse 21 says there in the second half of the verse that it pleased God, that it delighted God through the folly of what we preach to save those who believe. So we get this glimpse into the mind of God and his desires and his wisdom. It pleased God. God thought it good through the folly of what we preach to save those who believe. God saves people through faith and a very foolish message. And a message that's often shared and delivered by very insignificant people, by very insignificant messengers, by people who may not be thought of in the world's eyes as wise or intelligent. Who in the name of wisdom would have dreamed up a crucified Messiah? Really? I mean, in the name of wisdom, a crucified Messiah who is a criminal, a God who dies, who in the name of wisdom would have ever thought that up? Absolutely nobody. This flies right in the face of human logic and reasoning. God has destroyed man's wisdom by choosing to save people by faith, and then also by refusing to save people by wisdom. Look at verse 21. We'll begin all the way at the beginning of that. It says, for since in the wisdom of God, we're being reminded that God is infinitely wise. And in the wisdom of God, the world did not know God through wisdom. God in his wisdom made it such that the world would never find him by wisdom. Instead, it pleased God through the folly of what we preach to save those who believe. The first half of verse 21 explains that nobody comes to know God through human wisdom. Nobody gets saved that way. Nobody is presented with Christianity as a philosophy and goes, yes, light's coming on, that's it. God thwarts man from finding him by wisdom. When you come to the foot of the cross, you don't come there by way of your brain. No one comes to the cross because finally his brain and his intellect and his reasoning and his logic was ultimately satisfied. He comes because he has finally, ultimately been humbled by the clear teaching and implications of the cross. At the end of the day, the brain must bow, and only a fool from the human perspective can even be saved. We want to preach, I think, an intellectual gospel that satisfies the mind, but the gospel will never satisfy the human mind. It's absolute folly. The wisdom of God and the wisdom of man are mutually exclusive. People do not come to God by reason, they come to God by faith. You don't look at all the options, much as the man I described at the beginning, you don't look at all of the options and choose Christianity as the best one. And no man would ever do that. That's not saving faith. God thwarts man from finding him by wisdom, and God gives the opposite of what man's wisdom requires. God just plain and simply ignores what the mind wants. Look at verse 22. It says, for Jews demand signs and Greeks seek wisdom. Man wants something supernatural. Okay, if I'm going to learn the way of salvation and if I'm going to find God, I need something supernatural. Jews demand signs. Throughout his earthly ministry, the Jews were always saying to Jesus, show us a sign. If you're who you say you are, give us a sign. Give us some big display of power, a miracle, a visible display, something we can see. And that's what people want. They want something they can see with their eyes and something that will wow them with power, and they'll go, that's God. I'm going to follow him. And Jesus says to these people, you want a sign? I'm going to give you the sign of the prophet Jonah. That I'm going to die. I'm going to spend 3 days in the belly of the earth, basically. Just like Jonah was 3 days in the belly of the whale. Man's head wants to see something supernatural, not a dying man hanging on a tree. He also wants to see something rational. Verse 22 says, Jews demand signs and Greeks seek wisdom. Greeks is probably a reference to anybody who's not Jewish, Gentiles. The cross is so irrational from the human perspective. You think about it, a crucified Messiah, a God who dies, a criminal? None of this stuff makes any sense. And God just, again, he just ignores what the mind of man wants, and God provides what the heart needs. We need a crucified Messiah, and there's no other way. But a crucified Messiah is absolutely scandalous. Look with me at verse 23. Verse 23 says, but we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and folly to Gentiles. The cross of Jesus is like a stone that for the Jewish people, they'd be walking along and just trip over headlong and crash and burn. The cross is scandalous to them. It's preposterous. It's offensive. And the Jews would say, that's impossible. There is no way that God would hang on a tree. There's no way that the Messiah would die and hang on a tree. The Jewish law says in Deuteronomy 21, verse 23, that a hanged man is cursed or damned by God. And all the Jews could look and go, that man is damned. He's condemned by God. There's no way he's the Messiah. In fact, the Apostle Paul himself was so scandalized by the cross of Jesus before his conversion that he was trying to stamp out this whole belief in Jesus. That guy is not the Messiah, and he's going, trying to destroy and obliterate the church and everyone who believes that. He's so offended by it. By the way, as we share this message of the cross, we should probably expect that from time to time that is going to be the case. People are going to be greatly offended. They'll be greatly scandalized by this message. A crucified Messiah is scandalous, but he's also foolish. Verse 23 says that Christ crucified is folly to the Gentiles or anyone who's not Jewish. It's totally irrational. They say that's ridiculous. And yet a crucified Messiah is power and wisdom. Look at verse 24. But to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. When God does what he describes there in verse 24, and he effectually summons a person to salvation, and they repent and they believe, Christ crucified becomes to them the wisdom and power of God. And I think there's something interesting here. When do you see the wisdom of God? You don't really see the wisdom of God until you've experienced the power of God. You don't really see the wisdom of God until you've been saved by God. And all of a sudden, you're not tripping over the fact that Christ is damned. You say, he was damned for me. I'm the one who should be damned. And he took all of that. And all of a sudden, you marvel at this cross and you say, that is the wisdom and power of God. I can't, it's just mind-boggling, but it's so wonderful. It's so great. You don't really see the wisdom of God until you've experienced the power of God. Perhaps you've been sharing the gospel with someone for a very long time. Maybe they've been open. Maybe they've been listening. You've had many conversations. And maybe it seems like that person is like this close to salvation. Have you ever talked to someone like that? It's like they weren't necessarily opposed to it. And you're having these conversations. They're asking questions. And it's just like they're like this close. And mentally they understand the gospel. But it's like it just hasn't hit their heart yet. And maybe they're saying things like this, like, I just need to be sure. I just need to make sure this is true and that this is right. What if it's wrong? What do you do? You're talking to that person. I found myself recently having this very conversation with someone. What do you do? And I think we think, oh, I don't know what to do, and I need to answer all their questions and I need to help them see it so that finally they'll get saved. And yes, obviously we want to answer people's questions. The Bible does have answers. But often what we end up doing is we talk to them about the gospel like it's some kind of philosophy. Don't you see it's so great? Embrace it. But their human mind's never going to see it as so great. It's baffled by that. The human wisdom and the cross they're on totally different ends of the spectrum. So what do we actually do as we share the gospel? Yes, we answer questions. Yes, we take them back to God's truth. But ultimately, at the end of the day, what do? We take people back to the cross. We say, let's go back to the cross again. What does the cross say? If you keep bringing the focus back to the cross, you'll be sharing the gospel in power like the Apostle Paul instead of emptying it of its force and potency. And when you do that, when you keep taking people, let's just keep going back to this message. What inevitably happens is one of two things, and they're right there in verse 18. One of those two things eventually happens, and you know what? That's out of your control. The message of the cross destroys man's wisdom. Keep taking people back to it. Just a word of caution. I'd just warn you a bit about being careful how you speak to people. I particularly think of young people. When I was a youth pastor, it was common for me to be working with teenagers and young adults who grew up in Christian homes, right? They know the gospel. They know truth. It's like, I don't know how you could have missed this. Like, you've heard the gospel probably hundreds of times now. They were not saved. And you almost find yourself in those moments wanting to say, what are you thinking? You know the truth. You know the gospel. Why are you being so foolish? Why not be wise and follow Christ? That's how we think, right? So why don't you do that? But that message has no power. That's what Paul's talking about back in verse 17. That message has no power. That young person needs something else. What do they need? They need the message of the cross lovingly kept before them. We want to lovingly keep bringing people back to the cross. A third wonder of the cross is that the message of the cross magnifies God's glory. Look at verse 25. He's kind of beginning to sum up all of this. And he says, "For the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men." What is the foolishness of God? A crucified Messiah. His plan of salvation. His infinitely wise plan of salvation through a crucified Messiah. That's the foolishness of God. The foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God, a seemingly impotent man hanging on a cross. The weakness of God is stronger than men. And this verse is kind of saying, how do God and man compare? Well, God is wiser than man. God's foolish message of the cross far surpasses what man's wisdom can even comprehend. And God is stronger than man. The message of the cross is the power of God. God says this, instead of giving people displays of power and reason, I'm going to give them a display of weakness and folly. A cursed man who claimed to be God, hanging on a tree, dying. God's wisdom and power. Verse 21 says that it pleased God. God thought it good through the folly of what we preach, that message to save those who believe, who don't come to God by logic, but their brains bow and they come to God by faith. The message of the cross assaults man's heart, his soul, his inner man, not really the intellectual man. And in so doing, I think one of the things that we do not want to miss here, God is guarding his glory and the saving of men. How so? Well, the text that we looked at last week, people were focusing on the glory of man. And Paul and Apollos and Cephas. But the way this all works out, God says, man in his wisdom would never come to me. He would never do that. And people don't get saved when preachers stand up and mentally persuade people to come. It just doesn't even happen that way. What happens? The message of the cross is preached and people get saved. The preacher gets no credit. Because he's not this powerful persuader and orator persuading people by his eloquence and his rationale. He's just a herald saying, here's the truth. Here's the truth. Here's the cross, and it's thump, thump, thump straight into the hearts of men. The cross powerfully persuades, not the man. So the preacher gets no credit. The soul winner, quote unquote, gets no credit. And Paul and Apollos and Cephas get no credit. And the person who's just come to Christ gets no credit. He didn't, by his wisdom, come to Christ. He said that's folly. Until he experienced the power of the cross. Everything points to Christ, his cross, and the wisdom of the Father, so that at the end of the day, he alone gets the glory and none of us. Paul is trying to help these people get their bearings again by humbling them yet again through the gospel, and the gospel should have the same effect on us. Here we are drawn to worship man. Here we are to think about how wise we are and this and that and the other, and God says, you just keep going, go back to the gospel. Don't focus on Paul. Don't focus on Apollos. Don't focus on Cephas. Look at what I have done. The gospel, I think we could say, is a lot like a lion. Do you defend a lion? I mean, really, like, check out this lion. This lion could eat you. It's a lion. You don't even need to say that, right? You don't defend a lion. You just let it out of the cage, don't you? Let's just open up the door and out it goes. You don't need to defend that animal. And similarly, the gospel really doesn't need you to philosophically defend it and persuade people by it. Your job's just, as a messenger of the king, I'm just going to open up the cage and I'm going to let it out. It just needs to be let out. And God has granted you, a nobody, the privilege of doing that. And by the way, I should add, you are not the lion. I think some people think, I have the gospel and I am the lion. And they share the gospel as if they were a lion. The power is in the message itself. You're just the one who has the privilege to lovingly open the message. And let the lion out with love and tact. The message of the cross magnifies God's glory. And I would just encourage you as your pastor, keep sharing that message. Keep taking people back to that truth. You don't need great skills and, well, this is exactly how you talk to this person or exactly how you talk to that person. Well, that puts the focus on you. You just lovingly and graciously keep, here's the message. Here it is. And you let God do the work that only God can do. The gospel doesn't need you to give it a boost. Just faithfully share it. I think it'd be important as we wrap up here our time this morning just to invite anyone. Maybe you don't know much about this cross. It's a message of power. It's a foolish message. It tells us how God came to earth as a man to rescue sinners like you and me. And how he sacrificed his life on a cross and died as an innocent man, crucified, to satisfy the wrath of God. The wrath that you deserve because you're a sinner. He took the condemnation and all the judgment that you deserve on the cross in your place as your substitute so that you could be right with God and you could be at peace with your Maker. And God says to you, this cross, I've done something mighty for you. I've sacrificed my life to satisfy the wrath of the Father on your behalf so that you can have eternal life, so that you can have the righteousness of Christ. And he turns to us and he says, you must repent and you must believe. He does not turn to your mind, does he? He turns to your heart, to your will. And he says, turn from your sin and trust in me. Trust in the sacrifice of Jesus on the cross. It's not a matter of if your mind just puts all the pieces together. The cross says you are a sinner and Jesus is the answer. So turn from your sin and put your trust in him. You can do that in a simple prayer, even as we bow at this time. Would you bow with me this morning?